This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Homelessness is a hard thing for people of all ages, but particularly so for children. Western Wisconsin's Cooley Cap has been looking into the issue and its impact on the kids, families, our schools, and community in general, and in March released a report taking a regional look at the issues related specifically to child homelessness. In this interview with WPR's John Davis, recorded earlier this year, the executive director of Cooley Cap, Grace Jones, started by providing some background on what prompted them to pursue the study.
Cooley Cap, as part of its original mission, is to serve as a voice of the poor. And so we take very seriously the role of educating the community on poverty issues, issues that are affecting people who are most vulnerable in our society. And so on a couple times a year, we put out a paper called Community Concerns. Each paper has a different focus on a poverty or family issue. And this most recent one was about child homelessness. It's an issue that concerns us greatly.
Where does the information on child homelessness come from?
In our report, we use a lot of different sources. Organizations and the census data, but organizations that specialize in collecting data on homelessness, on child homelessness. So we're pulling information from a variety of reports and sources.
You looked at roughly 20 schools in your service area, correct? Refresh people's memory on what your service area is.
Well, Cooley Cap serves people in La Crosse, Monroe, Vernon, and Crawford. And one of the things we look at both school free and reduced lunch program numbers. For this particular report, we looked at school districts in the area and looked at a three-year average of the number of homeless youth that are in local school systems. And I can say that really every school district is dealing with homeless youth in our area. Unfortunately for La Crosse, the three-year average is 161 youth per year. But Toma and the Toma area also has a pretty high number at averaging 127 youth. Sparta, 68. Holman, 19. So every school system every school district is struggling to help these homeless youth as well.
That is one thing that struck me, is that every school district in the report had at least one homeless child at some point in that three-year period that you looked at.
Right, and including the rural counties as well. And the rural school districts had maybe two or four or seven on average, but still, if you think that even one homeless child is too many, then these numbers are pretty startling. And I think a lot of people don't realize that there are actually that many homeless youth in our area because we live in such a wonderful area.
Regina Siegel is Director of Pupil Services and Learning Supports for the La Crosse School District. How do you interact with the homeless student population in La Crosse?
As homeless liaison for the school district, we receive calls from secretaries and from the principals, counselors, social workers, sometimes teachers, when they have a concern and have a student or family in need. We work primarily with transportation. That's probably the biggest service that we offer our families. Children who are not able to get to school or live in a different part of the school district or even a different part of the region, by law, by the McKinney-Vento Act, are entitled to free transportation. We work a lot in the area of transportation, but we also help ensure that the children have the supplies they need for school and to be successful students during the school day. We help out schools. Sometimes they might need some additional curricular materials because the child is behind with their schooling or their education. So we try to help in whatever manner we can for all of our children.
Regina, how long has the La Crosse School District had programming to help the homeless?
For over a decade, and I would venture to say that if we asked the individual in my position, you know, about that, even decades and decades ago, they would say that they were serving homeless students, because we've always had homelessness, maybe not a law that protects the children and families as it does now, but For example, one of our greatest categories of homelessness in the School District of La Crosse is families who are doubled up because they were evicted or through economic hardship. Well, I know growing up as a child, we had many neighbors who they were living with grandparents or living with relatives or living with friends because they couldn't have a way to live and have a shelter otherwise, and that would be considered homelessness.
What does the programming for homeless students involve in the La Crosse School District, Regina?
So for any children and youth who lack a fixed, regular, and adequate nighttime residence, if we learn about those students, we qualify them as homeless, and then we provide services such as the ones that I mentioned in terms of transportation. We do a lot with area bus companies and transportation companies and cabs. We also make sure that we're working with the counselor and the social worker, teacher, administrator, support staff to get those school supplies, to make sure that they have what they need. We have coats and clothing that we provide for the children. The children automatically qualify for free breakfast and lunch through the federal lunch program, so they don't have to worry about meals. Often we hear that those are the only meals that they have, and so then they leave for the weekend and they can't wait to eat breakfast on Monday because they haven't had anything since Friday lunch, the previous week. And so those would be the biggest things: transportation, meals, school supplies, and support finding community resources.
I assume the idea with this program is to make it as normal as possible for mm-hmm. these students and protect their privacy and not give them some sort of stigma, isn't it?
Exactly. And that's where the clothing really helps. And actually, the Franciscan Sisters and Mike Schnitzius are working with us. They have a program that's called Hygiene for the Homeless, and they provide bags of full-size hygiene supplies for the children specifically. So, and they're beautiful things donated and purchased for the children in full sizes, because often homeless children and families are given, the little tiny sample size of toothpaste. Well, that might last them the first 3 days that they do not have a home, but not for the whole time. So that has been huge, making sure the children are able to shower, take care of themselves, and have clothing, that has been laundered and that is current with the styles of today. So that has been a huge resource and a way that we help destigmatize homelessness.
Most people know that school budgets are strained, and mm-hmm. is there a budget for the program that the La Crosse School District offers? And where does the money come from for that?
So our homeless transportation that is mandatory, that comes right off the top of district funding. We were successful in receiving a grant. We wrote for a grant to the Department of Public Instruction, and our district was selected to be a recipient of almost $50,000, and a big chunk of that is going towards transportation to ensure the safe transport of children all around the area. We also get many, many donations in addition to the Franciscan Sisters, whom I mentioned before. The La Crosse Community Foundation has really been supportive, even to the point of providing a generous donation of a van to the Boys and Girls Club, and they are helping us transport homeless children. That was an amazing donation from the Community Foundation. The La Crosse Public Education Foundation helps us with our Random Acts of Kindness funds. And one thing I would like to mention is the need for supports in the area of mental health. We see with all of our students, an increasing need to serve in those areas, and many of our homeless students have had traumatic events that have truly affected their ability to learn because they're, thinking about these terrible living situations they're in. We had a child who talked about, animals running all over him when he was sleeping at night, and he wasn't able to get any sleep, and so the teacher would provide a place in her classroom for him to have a morning nap. And this isn't a kindergarten student. This is a young man in a school. And, when he started talking, he talked about, cockroaches, large cockroaches, and different rodents. And working with the La Crosse County, we were able to go there and look and address that need. And it truly was a living condition that I don't think some folks, some of our listeners would even believe happen.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We're talking about the issue of child homelessness and how schools deal with it. Our guests are Grace Jones, the executive director of CULICAP, which recently issued a regional report on child homelessness, and Regina Siegel, the director of people services and learning supports for the La Crosse School District. I want to pick up again on that issue of funding and maybe bring Grace in here as well eventually. But for Regina, there is no specific fund at the federal government that will help with something like this. You are literally relying on volunteers and what little grant money is out there.
Mm-hmm. And after the issue of transportation, which we're required by law to address, there are not funds for that. And that's why we're so blessed to have places like the La Crosse Public Education Foundation, the La Crosse Community Foundation, our Franciscan Sisters and Volunteers, CULICAP, agencies that are committed to assisting and helping children in need, and often the whole family. We have area churches that find housing for folks, and of course our shelters. So no, there are not specific funds set aside for them.
Grace, I know this issue of homelessness is important for CULICAP to address. There really is no help for the homeless population in the government budgets?
Oh, no. We receive quite a bit of funding every year through a continuum of care effort in the supportive housing program. So we have at least four different programs that are a combination of federal funding, state funding, local donations, foundation funding from the Frankie Foundation, La Crosse Community Foundation, Bremer Bank, and so on. So this totals over $1 million a year, and we're able to help over 100 families in what I think is really wonderful programming. So you start with a family that's homeless, in trauma, the parents might be depressed, mom might be depressed, they're really in a really tough spot. And the funding allows us 2 years to help them get back on their feet. We provide subsidized rental apartments to them. They have to pay a portion of their income and rent as well. And then they have a case manager that works with them to help them really figure out their life, what went wrong, what do they need to do differently, do they need to go back to school, get a job. And it stabilizes the family, and really within a 2-year time period, they're back on their feet, they're moving out of that apartment or renting it on their own and have moved out of homelessness. So this is just a tremendous program that I absolutely love. We're helping about 100 families a year, like I said now, and that is, like I said, a combination of funding sources. Within those 100 families, we can have many children that are being served. And I think in our last count, there were 58 children who were in transitional housing programs across the four counties. A lot of these services are provided in La Crosse. And so I hate to think if the federal funding ever dried up, what would happen to, you know, over 100 families every year? How would they be served? Salvation Army is full up.
Homeless populations, I know, tend to be transient populations. So is the student who is starting in La Crosse, Regina, likely to finish the school year?
That's a great question. I should have mentioned that. Thank you for pointing that out. Another right that homeless students have under the law is that while they are homeless, they are able to stay within reason in the school of origin, it's called. So whatever school they began the school year with, that is what they can finish the school year with if they still live in the general area. Because of that, we're transporting kids from Onalaska. We have a family as far as Soldiers Grove that has two children who are actually taking the SMART bus and coming here to the La Crosse area. So yes, that is one of our primary goals, because we know that children who move every time they have a transition, I saw this statistic one time, every time they have a transition in a school, even if it's for a good and purposeful reason, like a change in career, a promotion for parents, they lose as much as 4 months of education. So if you can imagine children who maybe are in 7 or 8 different living situations in a year, and perhaps in a car and at Salvation Army, you know, in between those homes, we would have children at so many different locations. So that is a goal of ours.
Do you have different populations every school year, or are there some students who, you know, advance through several grade levels and are considered homeless?
That's a great question. When we used to have a look at our data years and years ago, we saw a lot of generational poverty and homelessness where it was the same families over and over who were homeless. And we still see a great deal of that, and that would probably be the majority of the population we serve. However, we are seeing more situational poverty lately and situational homelessness where perhaps there's a loss of a job and this is a family who has never, you know, missed a payment of a bill and has never had a problem securing a home, and all of a sudden they lose their living, you know, situation, and they're in a motel with, you know, 4 children sometimes and trying to make it work. And so then we have a number of families who are new to homelessness as well.
According to the Institute for Children in Poverty, homeless children are 9 times more likely to repeat a grade, 4 times more likely to drop out of school, 3 times more likely to be placed in special education with their peers. And then with young children especially, it can lead to changes in brain architecture, interfering with learning and emotional development, and can have such a long-term impact on those youth who are in a state of trauma due to homelessness.
Grace, according to the report, chances that somebody is going to be a homeless child in Wisconsin are pretty good in this country. I mean, it's like 8th, I want to say, if I recall, and maybe you can clarify that. But there are some interesting statistics about the issue of child homelessness and where Wisconsin ranks
right in
relation to other states in the nation.
Yeah, there's a report, America's Youngest Outcasts. And when you look at child homelessness in the country and kind of rank all the states on a scale of 1 to 50, 1 being best, 50 worst, the extent of child homelessness in Wisconsin, we rank 23, so kind of in the middle. The risk of child well-being, Wisconsin ranks 10th, so that's pretty good. We're near the top. Risk of child homelessness, as you said, John, we rank 8th. But then in terms of state policy and planning efforts, Wisconsin ranks 37. So what we could do in our state is a better job at really looking at this child homelessness issue and having some real policy work done at the state level and some changes made. That would be really quite helpful. And that kind of relates to nationally, there is only 1 bed available for every 125 youth who is homeless. And so there's a tremendous need for what you could call youth shelter beds, you know, safe, sanitary beds that youth can sleep in when they're homeless or runaways.
Is that discussion happening at either the state level or the federal level?
It's happening at the federal level. There's a national campaign for youth shelter, and it's fighting for a federal commitment to provide immediate access to shelter beds for youth that are homeless and under the age of 24. They're calling for 22,000 shelter beds to be established immediately. But in our state, I know there have been various efforts over the years, but I'm not aware of anything going on right now.
I do know there are some community folks who are very interested in looking at this issue of child homelessness. And when we talk about the data and how many homeless youth we have, I am always skeptical, because if you could see our data for the School District of La Crosse, over half of our homeless students are at the elementary level. And what we think happens is that families in need with little ones, or when classroom teachers see, you know, the kindergartner will come to them and say, I haven't eaten since lunch yesterday, or, you know, the situation I referred to, there were bugs all over me. Maybe I was in the campground, and we've had families, it's January, and they're camping in a campground without water or electricity. And, you know, we find out about this inadequate housing. When kids get to the middle school and high school level, I don't think they're telling us as much. And I know for a fact, I know personally, we have children who are couch surfing, who get either kicked out of homes, or they're runaways, or their parents have left. I think we'd be surprised at how many times that happens. Parents get up and leave, go to a different state, and leave their child back at home, hopefully with a neighbor or family member, but not always. And so I think we have a large percentage of unreported youth who are not homeless, not reported as homeless, and that is something that we're working on as well.
Regina, is there some evidence that by paying attention to these students, you've been able to make a difference in their lives?
We definitely have some great stories, and I'm sure as in all school districts in our area, we have teachers and staff and counselors and social workers and administrators who are truly committed to making a difference. One family that I think of is a family that was struggling with alcoholism and another number of other tough issues, some mental health needs in that family amongst the adults. And there was a gentleman who works in one of our nonprofits in the area, and he and his wife heard about this family. And the middle schooler and the high schooler had been couch surfing or had been in very unsafe places. And he and his wife took in these two children, April or May, even before that, and had these children living with them, not asking for any additional resources or support, afraid to go to the school to tell the school that they were living in a different area because they were afraid the children would be kicked out of the school and have to go to their resident district. So, you know, the community embracing these children, the counselor, the teacher, the administrator at the school when they found out, the school administrative assistant, you know, getting resources together. One of the children played basketball and didn't have money for the basketball shoes that the rest of the team was wearing. And so another gentleman from a different nonprofit came and purchased shoes for the child, you know, and not the cheap shoes that could have been the $30 shoes, which I can't believe I'm saying that's cheap, but the $100 shoes that the other children on the team had. So we are making a difference during that time. These children now are living back with the family. So the mom was able to get some help and support. There is a stable living situation, maybe not what you or I would consider a stable living situation, but it's the best that this family's had in quite some time.
So, Grace, the stock market's doing well. Unemployment is down in Wisconsin. Do you expect these numbers to get better?
Our experience is that low-income people are really the most vulnerable. So when a recession hits, they're the first one hit, and they're also the last ones to come out of it. And so we still see a tremendous increase in the number of families coming to our office experiencing homelessness and needing help, and we have 100 apartments. So we're turning away about 10 times more families than we used to have to turn away still. And I recently confirmed that with my staff. It's our hope the economy will improve. We try and help families as quickly as possible get back on their feet and move out so we free up another slot. But we haven't seen a tremendous amount of improvement in the economy for the homeless population or the low-income working folks in our community.
And Regina, you mentioned you're skeptical about the numbers we do have. Mm-hmm. And that they may be worse than we're able to document. Mm-hmm. Do you see the problem with homeless children improving at all in the La Crosse School District?
This past school year, in the 2013-14 school year, we went up by about a 10 to 12 students. So our numbers went up from 163 to 174 reported homeless students. I see the numbers continuing to go up or at least be at a stable number until truly as a nation, but in our community, we're able to address some of the issues that Grace has been referring to and the area of mental health for children and adults in our community. I don't anticipate those numbers going down anytime soon.
Is there anything else either of you would like to add?
I think on the older youth issues, so this is maybe when they've moved on from the school system, there are couple stereotypes that I think exist. First, 51% of all homeless people are white, and there's a tendency to think that we're talking about people of color or low, that it affects all people, although disparately affects people of color. So for example, 51% of the population that are homeless are white, but it's 88% of the population in Wisconsin. So people of color are really disparately impacted. And then also another issue that is of great concern to me is that it's estimated that 20 to 40% of the youth who become homeless are LGBT youth who have literally been thrown out of their homes and they've lost housing due to their sexual orientation. And I think this is just another real tragedy. Also, many homeless youth have been physically abused or emotionally abused, and so I would just like to dispel any concept of, you know, these are just bad kids that are running away and becoming homeless. They've had, you know, the school of hard knocks in their youth, and I think if we can assist them to make it through to adulthood in good shape, it's money well invested by our society.
Regina, we all know about the cycles of poverty and physical abuse and that type of thing and the efforts to break those. If a student comes into the La Crosse School District as a homeless student, is it the goal to work to break that cycle? Or are you just literally trying to get them a high school education?
We are definitely trying to make a difference in these children long-term and their families. So for homeless children, it's not just looking at having a place to eat or a way to get that food to a child that evening from one of our many food pantries in our school districts, schools, but it's helping work with the family to put them in touch with organizations like Coolie Cap, to bring them to people who we know help out the homeless, to give them job skills, to help them and their parents learn the tools that they may not have ever had the ability to see in action or to obtain so that they can turn around their lives.
Regina Siegel is Director of Pupil Services and Learning Supports for the La Crosse School District. Grace Jones is the Executive Director of Coolie Cap, the organization that issued a report this spring on regional child homelessness. They spoke with Newsmakers senior producer and editor John Davis. When we return, WPR's Maureen McCollum leads a conversation on Hear Here, a UW La Crosse initiative to collect and share audio stories about downtown La Crosse. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Archives of this and other Newsmakers programs, plus links to related information, can be found at our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. You can also link to the site and keep up on future programs by liking us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.
From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. Our stories can help create a sense of place and community. Some of those stories are well known, reported in the newspaper or repeated in history classes. Other stories aren't as widespread. Maybe they're personal or come from someone who's often not heard. The Hear Here Project hopes to bring more of these stories to light. Soon, people will see signs for the project around downtown La Crosse, showing them how they can hear more stories from members of our community. Here today to talk about the Hear Here Project are Ariel Beaujeau, she's a UW La Crosse Assistant Professor of History and Hear Here's Executive Director, Ariel Raker, she's the head curator of the project, and Emily Lovell, she's on the web design team. So Ariel, can you remind us exactly what is the Hear Here Project?
Hear Here is an audio documentary project that focus on is on downtown La Crosse. What it will look like to the public is signs that are orange up in downtown. They will have a 1-800 number, and when you call that 1-800 number, you'll hear a story of the space that you're standing in. that you're seeing that sign in. And then if you stay on the line, you can leave another a story of your own or a comment if you like. And we'll consider putting those new stories into the project as we move along. So we're launching with 30 stories, 30 signs. And then we're hoping over the next 5 years until 2020 to add another 30 signs, or maybe more if the public really takes this up.
And this was a project that involved UWL students and also community members too. Ariel, you're one of the students that's been involved in the project. Can you talk about that experience?
Being involved in a project like this is something that I expected to happen while I was in my career, not while I'm in my undergrad. Just the opportunity to be involved in a project like this is amazing. The experience, the connections with the community, and also just simply understanding how the process works of simply to get this up and running is just fantastic. There's so many things that you wouldn't think about that have really just been enlightening, and I know that in the future, if I would do something similar or even just any other type of project that has such close ties within the community, that I'd be able to draw on the experience that I've gained here.
And Emily, can you talk about how you decided to get involved?
So as a social studies teacher, obviously I'm interested in history, and I actually learned about the project from the state social studies DPI coordinator, who is not here in La Crosse. She sends out a listserv that I'm part of, and she said, hey, remember this class? I posted about it, and it sounds really interesting, and I clicked on it. I was like, oh my gosh, this is happening in La Crosse. And then I felt kind of bad that I didn't know about it. And I read about it and was just really interested to be involved. And I was very excited that they were looking for community members, because those opportunities aren't always available, you know, or open to people. They do a lot of cool things like that at the college level. So I was pretty excited about that and definitely immediately kind of joined up and was very excited. And just like Ariel said, I haven't necessarily had this kind of experience before. I didn't realize, I think, how big it was, you know, how incredibly large scale a project like this is. So it's been a really cool experience learning about just how that works, and then also connecting to the community and in a way that's just so unique and special. You know, I've lived in La Crosse for a long time, and this really makes me feel just a different kind of connection.
So are you able to incorporate some of these local stories, local histories into your social studies classes?
I sure hope I will. right now, I think I've been so focused on doing the class,
sure,
and the project itself. But for sure, I think that's a component we'll bring in later, and definitely, you know, talk with kids and invite them and parents and kind of tell them about it and bring that into the classroom. I think there's a lot of area to do that and a lot of ways to make that really meaningful.
And Ariel, how has working with not only UW La Crosse students but the community members, how has that really shaped what has come to be?
I think that's very, very important for this sort of project, because somebody like Emily has a lot of experience, and somebody like Ariel has less experience. And putting them in the same classroom, having basically like mentors and mentees, is an excellent situation, right? We also have two other community members, Terry Holford Talp and Sue Hessel. Sue is a very experienced journalist and also a historian, a local historian. So having her in the classes is really important. It helps the students understand what's going on long term in the downtown area. And it also helps the students make connections with the people that they will interview, and Emily had that experience, and with the media and so on. So having the community members in there just bolsters the work that we can do. It makes it stronger.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about the Hear, Hear project. My guests are Ariel Beaujeau. She's a UW La Crosse Assistant Professor of History and Hear, Hear's Executive Director. Ariel Raker is the head curator of the project, and Emily Lovell is on the web design team. I'm wondering if maybe we should just dive in and start playing some examples of these stories. First, we're going to hear from Martin Peoples. He talks about his experience as being homeless in La Crosse.
Well, you can say I chose the lifestyle. It's not only in La Crosse I lived this lifestyle. I mean, we're talking about almost 39 states I lived this lifestyle. The only loving part was the churches. So I slept pretty much in the street. I slept in laundromats. I slept in stairwells, in the parks. I guess my major activity was panhandling. And that's where the really, for the next 4 years, I lived downtown. The places I mostly stayed was at the cathedral. They have a little, it was a garden back there. Mm-hmm. They had like a chair.
So why was it that you decided to interview Martin Peoples? And we should say that this sign is actually outside of the cathedral downtown.
It is. When we would interview people, we would also have the decision about where to place the signs as well. And I decided to put it at the cathedral because, like he said, he slept so many different places. He lived so many different places downtown. But that was one of the most specific places he spoke about. I was connected with Martin Peoples through Thomas Harris, who works with the Office of Multicultural Student Services on campus here. And Thomas and Martin have had a very close relationship for many years now. Martin has come and done Boxes and Walls, which is it's like a forum on homelessness mm-hmm. on campus. Martin's an extremely intelligent man. He went to college. He came from a home of over, I think there were 12 foster kids. So he is someone who is extremely intelligent and in the interview, you'll find out, how he really came to live this lifestyle.
And it's interesting, too, because especially outside of a cathedral where so many really important moments in people's lives occur. I mean, people could call in and add their story about their weddings, going to church, mm-hmm. finding God, losing God. You have the story about homelessness. And that, Ariel, probably just goes to show just how there are so many stories
In each space. Yeah. And that's really what we're trying to do with this project is to think as a community of all the different things that have happened in space and then connect that to ourselves, right? Why is it that Martin Peoples has had such a different experience in that same space as somebody that was married there, right? What does that mean for our community, that the same space is going to mean something so different for different people? There's a big concept of psychogeography that's in this project, and psychogeography is about space and how we feel in that space and how our memories come back based on space. Just like with smell or taste, memories can come back. It's the same with space. But to externalize that idea of the fact that we have memories in our heads of space will help us think about our community differently. And I think maybe even move forward as a community. Is it okay that certain people have felt this way in this space, even when somebody else was in that space feeling something very different? Is that okay with us? And what can we do about it as a group of people?
These stories also touch on some controversial topics, too. I next want to play a clip from Dan Green's interview. We'll play the first minute or so, and then maybe you can elaborate a little more on what he talks about. Let's hear from Dan Green.
We're in the north end of Riverside Park. I just turned my back symbolically on what the UWL Native American students used to refer to as the Colossus of Kitsch, or as Riverside Park calls the Big Indian. First, my name is Kedicho Maniga. That means the person who paints the sky blue. You know me as Dan Green, what Malcolm X might have called my slave name. At the time, the late 90s, the Chamber of Commerce in La Crosse proposed $50,000 into a paint job on the Colossus, something that reinforces stereotypes about Native Americans. As a sociology student, I had for years looked into the influence of imagery, statuaries, and I was a part of the national anti-Native American sport mascot movement. I traveled to University of Illinois, University of North Dakota, and Cleveland, Ohio on a regular basis to demonstrate and to teach about the harms, the largely psychological harms of this kind of imagery of the big Indian standing behind me.
And he goes on to talk about his experience in that place. But why was it that you decided to talk with Dan Green?
We wanted to include voices of people who are typically not heard in the community or perspectives that maybe aren't the average type of perspective that we hear about. And Dan Green is someone that I, knew of and knew that he was a very well-spoken and well-informed person.
And he teaches here on UWL's campus.
Yes, he does. Yeah. And so I had known about him when I was in college, And then when this kind of came back, I was like, wow, he'd be a really good person to get in touch with. And then actually doing our research before we went out and did the stories, I found several pieces that he had written over the years for different different publications. And so I was just really moved, I think, by his level of intelligence in order to speak of this. You know, it's not just someone saying, oh, this is how I feel about this, but really he has a really educated perspective and also a personal perspective. So it's also his own experience. And I just really felt like that would speak well to, you know, what we're trying to do here. And so that's why I chose him, and he was very willing to be part of the project. And I think, you know, for someone who's been talking about these issues with imagery his whole life, who's been very passionate about it and not always gotten the best responses to it, I think he felt really kind of honored to be part of another thing, and not coming from him himself taking it out there, but that we were kind of looking for that, and we're kind of wanting that perspective, I think really touched him.
Because there probably are many people who walk by that statue who might not think twice about it and might mm-hmm. not understand Dan's perspective of that place.
Yeah, and something I think... when you get into topics like the imagery, a lot of people really feel passionately like, well, it's an honoring thing, and you know, they just tend to kind of pass it off and not want to look into the issue. And I really appreciate his perspective of saying, it's not that I think we should get rid of these things. It's not that I think these things themselves are the only problem, but really in the rest of his interview, he talks about how we need to bring them into the modern day. We need more modern perspectives of all people and not just looking at people in the past. So I think it's a really powerful message, not just saying this is bad or this is good, but we need to examine the issue a little bit further.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're talking about the Hear, Hear Project. My guests are Emily Lovell. She's on the web design team. Ariel Raker is the head curator. And Ariel Beaujeau is a UW-La Crosse Assistant Professor of History and Hear, Hear's Executive Director. There are also some stories that use archival audio in this project. We're going to play just a short clip from Gustav Winter. The quality it's a little hard to tell because we think the interview is probably from the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We can. Well, back there in the early days, where you were a kid, they also had houses of ill repute.
Oh.
Do you remember those?
I used to deliver packages there from. I used to work with the Continental Men, and they were beautiful places, and they were.
Tell us about it. Tell us about it.
Now, if I tell you about that thing, I was a visitor.
Yes, I know.
Well, I deliver packages.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
But now, where were they?
They were from 2nd and J down to Front Street and then over to King Street, one block square.
One block square?
Yeah.
And what were the names of the places?
Well, Rose Vermont was one. That was a high-class place. Hattie Bauker was another one.
Gustav delivering packages to houses of ill refute in downtown La Crosse.
I love the Gustav Winter stories. In fact, there's a number of Gustav Winter type stories in this project.
Now, so you found this audio through the UWL archives?
Yeah, okay. Exactly. So Laura Godden has really helped us out with this, mm-hmm. and Terry Helford Talp as well, find the location-based stories from the oral history collection.
Why incorporate archival audio?
Because a lot of what we have is present-day stories, which is totally fine, but it helps us to think about where our downtown was at a certain point. What was it like when the Mississippi was really used a lot for transporting more things? What was it like when La Crosse was a hub in that transportation system, along with the railroad that used to run downtown? What that brought was a red light district. And it took a while to get rid of that, and now we would never think about the downtown being a red light district, right? But the perspective that we get from Gustav Winter that I find so fascinating is that he talks about how it's problematic not to have that red light district because it means that women are no longer protected by a space where the police would know to go if there's a problem, as opposed to prostitution that is currently on the street and women are less protected.
Are there other stories that you're looking forward to sharing with people? Ariel, is there anything that jumps out at you?
I'm less excited about the stories and more excited about the community's reactions to them.
Really?
Yeah. I'm really, really interested to take different groups of people downtown and see how they react to them. Because speaking with friends that I have that are like in ATP and are more socially justice minded, like they love it. They think it's awesome that they're coming out and all these stories. And speaking with some of my closer friends who are less versed in that type of stuff, they're like, oh, well, but, you know, that I could see that business really not liking this story. And so I'm really excited to see the community's response.
What do you think that we can learn from each other through these stories?
Well, I know I learned so much from interviewing Martin. He's such an intelligent man. And in another part of the interview, he talks, well, the interview was very long, but another part, he talks about how you never think that that's going to be your life. You know, growing up, you always have this idea, you have this image of what your life is going to be like. And it's really not until you get to that point that you really understand what it is. I think that is especially memorable for college students because, you know, we are getting our major and that's dictating our life and our job. And, you know, we're meeting people and we're making plans and we're really planning out the rest of our lives at this point. But I think it's also important to remember through stories like Martin that things happen and life is what it is and you can't plan everything.
Emily, you mentioned before that you're hoping to potentially incorporate some of these lessons into the classroom. Do you think this is something that schools could get involved in?
Oh, absolutely. Especially schools that are closer geographically.
To the downtown area?
Yeah, to the downtown area. I think, you know, we had talked, and especially, you know, if you're talking like eighth graders and older, to actually physically bring them and let them experience listening to the stories could lead to so many opportunities for teachable kind of moments. And I get kind of overwhelmed thinking about it because I think there's just so much you could do with that. I teach sixth grade, so I don't know. I don't know that I would do it quite the same way with kids that age, but especially because we have the website and we have access to it from anywhere, I think that there would definitely be ways to incorporate that and bring that in and work with that. That would be very meaningful and very cool and help kids connect to it. You know, just like we're trying to help people in the area connect in a personal way. You know, these aren't just random people from history. These are people that are around. These are people that, you know, you could talk to, you could meet, or people from our own community, at least, that we're hearing them talk about their own experiences, which I just think is so powerful.
You mentioned the website, which you've been working on, yep. And it looks gorgeous, by the way. It's really neat because there's that nice little interactive map. So, you know, if someone moved away from La Crosse, they can still take almost like a digital tour.
Yeah,
of these stories.
And that's exactly what the website is meant to provide. You know, obviously, not everybody can get downtown. Not everybody who would be interested in this project lives nearby. So it kind of bridges that gap for people either with accessibility issues, you know, they actually just physically maybe can't go out and do that, but would be interested.
The accessibility issue is pretty impressive because I think it seems like, Ariel, you've tried to make it as accessible as possible to all people.
That's why we chose to do a 1-800 number rather than a QR code or an app, because
like the little digital scanner.
Yeah, that's right. So we did that for the reason of accessibility, right? Everybody or most people have cell phones, even if they're just flip phones. So it includes the people, all people that have interviewed. Like people who are homeless or semi-homed, for example, can still access these stories and for free. And so that's part of the reason why. Also, the students early on decided that we should do transcripts for people who are hearing impaired. So that's another way. And then we've done all kinds of other work for accessibility. For example, there's one step up to our location. We were very careful to choose something that was accessible, and so we got a ramp donated so that people can get into the space if they're in a wheelchair.
I know you want to add more stories over the years. Are there other, do you envision other activities centered around the Hear project?
Yes.
Do you know what those are? Yet?
Yes, I do. Okay. So there's two of them. One is really something that Emily's been talking about. We will develop educational programs around it, around the Hear project. And then the other thing that we're really interested in doing is I've been talking to William Staub, who is in the English department here. He's a poet, and he's interested in doing poetry, place-based poetry as part of here. So maybe next year we're thinking of bringing, doing a, basically starting the day with a workshop where we think about place-based poetry and think about writing that. But before that, we'll do a call to poets, and we'll ask for poets to hand in stuff that has to do with downtown La Crosse, and we'll choose certain poems to highlight. We'll then set up happenings around downtown, a couple of happenings in the morning, a couple in the afternoon, where people will read their poetry, and the Hear Hear team will record that. And then we'll have a roving Hear Hear reporter who, as people come up with poems, we can record them on the street throughout the day. And then we're going to have the poet laureate speak in the afternoon. It's bringing in a new type of story into the project, but I think it's still really will work with the project, right? Because it's still place-based. It's still kind of thinking broadly about our history and our time in the spaces of downtown.
Ariel Beaujeau is a UW La Crosse Assistant Professor of History and the Executive Director of the Hear Hear Project. Ariel Raker is the Head Curator, and Emily Lovell is part of the web design team. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Stroub, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. Visit WPR.org/newsmakers to find the Hear Hear website, along with today's show and other recent editions of Newsmakers. If you'd like to share a comment or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff, that and more at WPR.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.